White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew. Tonight is episode 80, and it is January 16th, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
And we're going to be reading chapter 75, The Jewish Question in Current Testimony. Current testimony means what's being said in the time, which was 1921. It's pretty darn interesting. Scary stuff, because it's all the Jewish terrors going on in Russia and things like that. Do you have any comment, pre-reading comment about it, Hadding?
I agree, it's very scary.
Yes, it is. I was looking for a scary picture to put on the post, but I haven't come up with one yet. You know, I'm still complaining about these Google images. Where they don't have what you really want, because they cover up for the Jews, so they don't show all the bad stuff about the Jews that you'd like to see. That's my opinion. Well, we have a little bit of a long on the longish side tonight, so let's just get started, huh?
Alrighty, chapter 75, The Jewish Question in Current Testimony. The Jewish question continues to attract more and more attention. In many quarters, a new tendency toward freedom of the press is observed, and the long-concealed truth is getting itself spoken bit by bit. It has been thought worthwhile, before going on to other phases of the study of the Jewish question, to present in this article a few of the informative or confirmatory articles that have appeared in the public press. It need not be said that, with a single possible exception, none of the writers or publications here quoted could be called anti-Semitic. Not even the most unreasonable Jew could append that term to any writer or publication cited here.
Oh, they would, though. They do, though.
Oh, yeah. Well, Jews can say many crazy things.
That's right. Unreasonable things.
I'm sort of paraphrasing the Shah of Iran there. The Associated Press sent out a dispatch which was printed in the American papers of August 24th, 1921, as follows. Thousands of Russian Jews are crossing the Estonian, Lithuanian, and Polish borders every month, many sent from Soviet territory under protection of a high Bolsheviki officials, according to travelers in the border states who recently have returned here. The opinion in neighboring states is that the exodus is prompted by fear of an approaching crisis. The fact that no appreciable organized Russian anti-Bolshevik movement has appeared since Baron Wrangel's forces were dissipated leads observers of the situation here to believe that should the overthrow of the Soviets occur this winter, it will take the nature of a popular uprising, supported by such troops as are not at the front. Many fear it will result in a widespread anti-Jewish program. For these reasons, every Jewish family of means, and many that are destitute, are attempting to get out of Russia. They have no desire to tarry in Lithuania or Estonia, but are seeking to enter Germany, with the idea of eventually reaching America.
I'm sure the Germans appreciated that.
Well, you know, now they had a warning, and it says here that there's no appreciable organized Russian anti-Bolshevik movement. And yet they think that there might be a popular uprising. Well, I guess they mean by the people. Well, fat chance. The people were too darn scared to go out and
well,
fight.
Well, I think they still had the white army to fight at that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, in any event, they were expecting things, but it didn't happen. Okay.
But that was the big influx of Jews into Germany.
Uh-huh.
And also into America. I was reading a couple of days ago something that said that there were actually very few, there were actually, as far as Jewish families that had been in Germany for a long time, there were actually not very many, and their numbers were on the decline, you know, as of about 1900. They were less than 1% of the population and shrinking. But they had all of these immigrant Jews, and that's where the real trouble was.
That's right. That's right. They've always said in Germany that the ones, the German Jews who are the real German Jews were not a problem, really. Not that much, you know. Of course, they were the bankers and they were all this stuff. But it was these immigrants that from the East that were so terrible between the two wars that did so much damage.
Yeah, and also from France and the other Western occupied countries, they didn't deport Jews except those that had no roots in those countries.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. That's right, really. People, that's things, you know, you can say that, but no, people don't pay attention to it. Oh, well.
To give the reader the background of this fear, we offer part of a letter from Kishinev, which was received by a North Dakotan. My dear friend Gutsche, for 1 month no fugitives arrived, but now many of them are coming from the Ukraine to Bessarabia, most of whom are Jews. They are a different lot than the former fugitives were, for they are wearing costly clothes, furs, precious stones, jewels, and so on, such as was seen before the war only by very well-to-do people, landowners and the like. They have money and money's worth. There is no doubt that these fugitives had leading positions in the Bolshevik regime. Perhaps they were commissars or even judges on the blood and inquisition courts of the so-called Trzeszowskaja. Chaika, Trzeszowskaja, or short Cheka. Their purses and pockets are filled, not with worthless paper money, for they themselves have manufactured that, millions and billions of it, which they have thrown before the Christian brood, the goys. No, filled with money and precious jewels, which no more show traces of blood and tears, but shine and glitter, the same as in those happy hours of their rightful owners. But the people over there, in Russia, are awakening. They wonder about the source of all this terror. The children of Judah know the answer thereto, but they prefer to leave the ground which is becoming unsafe to stand upon. It is getting too hot for them. The nemesis is raising her head from out of the blood of innocence, which calls to heaven for revenge. Yes, they fear the result of their actions and wish to save their skins before it is too late. In this they succeed, but not always are they allowed to keep their furs, their stones, and precious metals. They overlooked the Romanians. These people are very vain and greedy for costly things. The newcomers are on their way to America, and the doors on all borders are willingly opened to them, even to the soldier in the army. Only on again, the faster the better. I think that someday America will have so many Semites that they, the Semites, will be looked upon the same as the colored, the black, yellow, and brown races. Imagine for a moment that there were no Semites in Europe. Would the tragedy be so terrible now? Hardly. They have stirred up the people in all countries, have incited them to war, revolution, and communism. They believe in the saying that there is good fishing in troubled waters. But enough of the chosen people. Someday they will reap what they have sown.
Oh, yeah.
Another picture. Every 3 or 4 days, a razzia, domiciliary search graves, is being conducted in the city.
What does that mean? Domiciliary search is that they're going around terrorizing people by searching them.
I guess.
Yeah.
Terror, fear, and oppression drive the people from the streets, looking for hiding places. The people do not work, eat, or sleep. Only stamping, cursing patrols are seen on the streets with their victims. In this manner, 200 or 300 persons are often driven together, former civil and military officials, teachers, landlords, businessmen, and so on. Only Christians, seldom Jews. Among them also women. This group is then led to the Trzeciwska. In front of the group are 40 to 50 armed Red Guards, infantry and on horses. Right and left about the same number of guards. In the rear, several carriages or an automobile with machine guns. And behind that again, infantry and horseback riders. When this group is seen on the streets, everyone flees terrified. Occupants of houses peep through cracks and press their hands to their hearts to see what father, brother, son, or other relatives led away from their once happy homes, perhaps never to return again. This they know. Those behind doors and windows where occur hysterical spells, heart failures, and deaths. Words cannot express the terror of it all.
So this was an eyewitness there who was writing to his friend in North Dakota. And what he was doing there, I don't know, but it makes it a horrible story here. I mean, it's frightening, you know. I can just picture this, and these, you know, these heartless, inhuman people, and there you are, these people in their clutches, and God knows what their fate is going to be. It's really terrible.
Yeah, I'm going to guess that this Gutsche that was addressed at the beginning of the letter is a German, ethnic German, perhaps of Russian German derivation, and maybe this is some relative of his that was still in Russia.
Yeah, there you go.
Friend or relative.
Sounds good.
Because a lot of the Germans that settled in the Midwest were from Russia, especially like Nebraska.
Uh-huh.
And then at the Trzeciwska, there are youths, mostly circumcised, often half or wholly drunk. Should there be personal enemies among the judges, the unfortunate ones are executed either on the same day or the next one, but are sometimes also tried, like they tried the heretics in the Inquisition chambers.
Yeah, these judges are these youths.
Yeah.
These half-drunk youths who are, you know, going with the party or whatever, and so, you know, how horrible. Ooh.
Yeah, and they're Jews.
Yeah, circumcised.
Several of these creatures of the Trzeciwska, and especially a certain Wichmann, a Jew, of course, carry on terribly. He is the terror of the city and the flat land. He even kills Bolshevist commissars and their wives, should they now and then reveal a more humane feeling. They fear the reprisal and hasten across the borders, laden down with valuables. More suffering is caused in the cities by hunger and cold. The dead bodies are buried without coffins and often without clothes. How the people dwell in houses I shall perhaps relate next week. Enough for today. F. Horch.
Yeah, well, that is a German name, right?
Yeah.
Well, now, you know, and so the Jews are, the Jews who have the wealth, it sounds like what they're saying, they are fleeing too, because it says they, even the Bolshevist commissars and their wives are sometimes, you know, condemned to death. And so they're all trying to go laden down with valuables, you know, so they can pay their way and all. But the other people, the ordinary Russian people, probably cannot do that. So there they are.
Yeah. Well, the early Bolshevism was a big mess.
Oh.
Stalin was the guy that made the whole system work.
Well, who was running it then in the early part? That was Lenin.
Yeah, it was the Jews basically kind of did what they wanted to do in the early years of Bolshevism.
Yeah.
And then Stalin changed the direction of things. He decided, you know, this nonsense isn't working.
Yeah.
And he decided, you know, he copied a lot of things from the Prussians, actually. I mean, they reorganized the educational system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Jews had all of this, all these progressive educational ideas that they were implementing that didn't work worth a hoot. And
yeah.
Stalin just put an end to all that nonsense.
Well,
but those same ideas have been revived in American educational theory recently. Ones that Stalin threw out.
Well, at that time, that was the beginning of American progressive education, wasn't it, in the 20s? Or in the 30s and so on?
The freedom of the Balkan Jew from the hunger and suffering which afflict the native peoples is vividly set forth in the words of an American. Our ship is the first to enter Libau on a peaceful mission since the war, they say. At any rate, our arrival has caused a great excitement on account of the food cargo we have for these people.
Hey, let me interrupt. Where exactly is Libau?
Apparently it's in the Baltic states.
Yeah, well, right. I thought you might know exactly.
Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia. One of those.
Balkan, not Baltic.
Balkan.
Isn't that down? Yeah, Balkan.
Oh, it says Balkan.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. So well, you should look
there.
That up while I'm reading.
Yeah, okay. I'll do that now. I'll look it
Balkans.
Up.
Balkans. It might be Romania.
Yeah, right. Might be. Okay.
At present, we are tied up to a quay in a narrow stream that seems to be also a sewer. Unloading our flour is a ticklish piece of work due to the terrible hunger of the crowd that watches us. Whenever a bag breaks, people fight to scrape up the loose flour, which they put into cans along with a good portion of dirt that is mixed into it.
Well, you know, I keep getting Latvia. I can't figure this out. Manitoba, they've got a Libo in Canada. Canada. And, oh, gosh, that's not the one I want.
Everyone has a tin. Did you find it?
Well, Libau, Wikipedia, may refer to Manitoba, the German name for something else. A ship renamed Oud. Okay, Lipaja, let me look that up. That
is
a
German
city.
Name.
Yeah, it's a German name. Lipaja is a city in, I have to expand this, in Poland or in Latvia. Well,
yeah.
It's funny. Latvia on the Baltic Sea.
There you go.
Well, why do they call it the Balkans instead of the
Baltic? I guess that was a mistake.
Yeah, okay.
So I got it right instinctively.
Yes, you did. So it was way up there in the north. What I call the north, not where I was thinking about. That makes a little bit more sense. It's so terrible up there. what was going on. Okay. Well, I interfered enough, but we got that straightened out.
Everyone has a tin can, and at noon, there was almost a riot over a bucket of potato peelings that were tossed into the water. The people tied strings to their cans and went fishing for the peelings. They stand all day and beg us for food. It is not a very pleasant sight, this crowd of emaciated, white-faced men and women and big-eyed children. The most damnable thing about it all is the dozen Jews who flit like magpies through the crowd. They are young, soft, well-groomed, and prosperous. They carry canes, wear new straw hats, and resemble the kind you see in the States. They have nothing in common with the other people. They have money, plenty of it, and they seem to think this ship is a floating peddler's cart and tobacco store. They come up to the gangway and wave British five-pound notes in the air, offering them for a carton of cigarettes. Or they have gold watches that they will trade for a few pounds of soap. From the looks that other people favor them with, I do not wonder that we hear about periodic slaughters of the Jews in Russia. These fellows look too prosperous in comparison with the rest of the population to suit me.
I was wondering about that British five-pound notes. So why do they have British money?
I don't know. Maybe they may have been, speculating in currencies and saving currencies, using foreign currencies with the expectation that the Lithuanian, Latvian, or Estonian money wasn't going to be any good, you know?
Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. The peculiar character of Jewish cruelty in Russia is so little in accord with the character of the Jews as we propagandized Americans have been taught to conceive it, that even the Dearborn Independent, in its desire to present a consistent account of Jewish activities as they relate to the United States, has not opened this special phase of the study of Jewish psychology. The sadism displayed throughout the Russian Terror has been discussed briefly in The World Significance of the Russian Revolution by George Pitt Rivers. Did you know who he was?
I looked it up. Yeah, I'd heard it. I heard his name before, but I looked that up, and it came out in 1920. Yeah. And they've got it on Amazon now. Well, it's on archive.org. It's in it, can be read. I should read it, but...
George Pitt Rivers was an anthropologist.
Uh-huh.
He was also the cousin of Winston Churchill's wife. And he was, I believe, an hereditary noble. And he was also very pro-Hitler and was invited to the 1937 Nuremberg rally.
Did he go?
And the British government put him in prison in 1940 under Regulation 18B, where they imprisoned people that were not behind the war effort.
Right. What do you know? Winston Churchill's wife is reportedly was Jewish, although that's never been really clearly decided upon, but she sure has a Jewish name. She had a Jewish name. So that would mean if he was related to her, he might have had some of that, but probably if he did, it was so little, or maybe he didn't have any.
There is, however, American Jewish testimony on the same point. It is found in the April 1921 number of the Hebrew Christian Alliance Quarterly.
I thought, is that a forerunner of the Christian Zionists? You know, they had a Hebrew Christian Alliance. They had a lot of things like that.
I don't know. Rabbi Yechiel Eckstein might be able to tell you.
Yeah.
In an article entitled Persecution is not the monopoly of Christianity and is contrary to its principles.
Well, but this was written by a Christian man.
Oh, yes. In an article entitled Persecution is not the monopoly of Christianity and is contrary to its principles. The Reverend M. Malbert, B.A. of Ottawa, Ontario, says, "We must now proceed to deal with our last point. The Jews blame Christianity for its persecuting spirit. They consider it a monstrous thing to persecute another person for his convictions. Now, the question is, are they themselves free from the persecuting zeal? I'm going to show that real religious persecution is uniquely Jewish, and that they themselves have been the relentless persecutors. In the year 120 BC, John Hyrcanus, son of Simon, the last of the Maccabean brothers, who fought against the Syrian hosts in defense of their religion, persecuted other religions. He destroyed the Samaritan temple on Mount Gerizim. Next, he conquered the Edomians and bade them choose between exile or Judaism. They chose the latter. That he made a mistake in forcing his religion on an unwilling people may be seen in the treacherous Herodian dynasty, Edomian converts, who were a curse to the Jewish nation. The intolerant religious spirit among the Jews themselves is unique in history. In the Maccabean princes, the royalty and the high priesthood were united in one person, King Alexander, third son of John Hyrcanus, who was a Sadducee. The Pharisees, therefore, hated him. In the year 95 BC, on the Feast of Tabernacles, as he was officiating in his high priestly capacity in the temple, instead of pouring the water on the altar, he spilled it at his feet. The congregation worshiping with the palm branches and citrons in their hands, noticing the water spilled at the high priest's feet, started to pelt him with them. The king's life was in danger, and he was constrained to summon to his aid the Pisidian and Cilician mercenaries. Those fell on the people and slew 6,000 within the precincts of the temple. The hostility of the Pharisees was more bitter against the king, and their hatred knew no bounds. But the king endeavored to make peace with them. He therefore summoned their chief men and told them that he was tired of the feuds and that he desired peace. What were their conditions? They replied, "Death of the king." Then they actually set out to betray their country. They invited the Syrian king, Eucharis, to invade Palestine, and treacherously offered him their aid. Eucharis advanced upon Judea with 43,000 men. The Pharisees kept their promise and fought in the camp of their country's enemy against their king, who was eventually defeated. The poor king, the descendant of the heroic Maccabees, wandered about in the mountains of Ephraim. At last, 6,000 Pharisees, conscience-stricken, returned to him from the Syrian camp. With these 6,000 penitents, he was able to force the Syrians from Judea. But the majority still remained hostile and made war against him. But they were finally defeated and reaped the fruits of punishment that they deserved.
You know, I'm going to stop right there, and I'll stop you, and point out, I hope people have noticed, that three times they've used, on two different instances, two different occasions, they've used the number 6,000 for the number of, you know, this stuff is just mythology in large part, so, I mean, they just dream it up. But isn't that interesting how they've got 6,000? It has to be that six number followed by zeros, whether it's 6,000, 6 million, or 60 or whatever, is pretty special. And always crops up.
Yeah, it's usually taken for granted by scholars that numbers given in ancient histories are not reliable.
Well, no, of course not. And they grow. We don't know. I don't know about these stories, but they're plenty elaborated on, I'm sure. But that's kind of interesting. Also, the way these people, when they said they wanted the death of the king, what could the king do? The king could give up his life, and then they'd be happy. Makes me think of the traitors. It did make me think of the traitors in Third Reich Germany who wanted the death of Hitler. But even the death of Hitler was not good enough for the British and the Americans who wanted more than that. So
yeah,
but these traitors were willing to offer the death of Hitler. Anyway.
The Jewish king himself was intolerant, and he forced many heathen cities to embrace Judaism. Those who refused were destroyed. Simon ben Shetach, president of the Sanhedrin, condemned 80 women to be crucified for witchcraft. The son of Simon ben Shetach was accused by his enemies of some breach of a religious precept, and although the father himself knew him to be innocent, he nevertheless sentenced him to death and allowed him to be executed. Between the school of Hillel and Shammai, there was constant bloodshed. The trial and execution of Jesus were the natural outcome of religious intolerance. The greatest service to God a Jew thought possible was to persecute the Christians. Rabbi Tarfon said that the Gileon, that is, the Gospels and all the writings of the Minim, that is, the apostolic epistles, should be burned even with the holy name of God in them. He maintained that Christianity was more dangerous than paganism, and he would rather fly to a heathen temple than to a meeting house of the Minim. A curse against the Minim was inserted into the Jewish daily prayers at that time, which is still used by the congregations.
Now, the Minim was a gathering of the Christians.
Evidently.
A certain amount, maybe, that they had to have or whatever. Yeah, but that's what that represents, the Christians. This is a pretty interesting section here, I think. It continues.
Yeah, it is.
Still. Yeah.
Bar Kosiba, the false Messiah, persecuted the Christians without mercy. That was a second insurrection that the Jews did at Jerusalem that the Romans had to put down. He's also called Bar Kokhba. Revelo Oliver has an article where he refers to him.
Yeah, Bar Kokhba is one I've seen. Yeah, well, they had a few of these false messiahs that managed to get quite a following before they were slaughtered by somebody.
Even in the time of Justinian in the 6th century, the Jews massacred Christians in Caesarea and destroyed their churches. When Stephanus, the governor, attempted to defend the Christians, the Jews fell on him and slew him. In 608, the Jews of Antioch fell upon their Christian neighbors and killed them with fire and sword. The Patriarch Anastasius, surnamed the Sinaite, was disgracefully ill-treated by them, and his body dragged through the streets before he was finally put to death. About 614, the Persians advanced upon Palestine, and the Jews, after joining their standard, massacred the Christians and destroyed their churches. 90,000 Christians perished in Jerusalem alone. The Jews expected fair play from the Persians as a reward, but were treated worse by them than by the Christians. In 628, the Emperor Heraclius had retaken Palestine from the Persians, and when marching through Tiberias, he was entertained by a wealthy Jew named Benjamin, the same man who invited the Jews to join the Persians against the Byzantines. The emperor asked him what had induced him to betray so great an animosity against the Christians, to which he replied that they were the enemies of his religion. Yet they claim the prophecy of Isaiah in the 53rd chapter to have been fulfilled in them. He was oppressed, and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. They even persecuted Muhammad in the incipient stages of his career. They prejudiced the chief Arabs against him, helped his enemies to discredit him, and endeavored to alienate his followers.
Well, you know, this all this all this hatred toward the Christians and all of the all the destruction that they carried out on violence that they carried out on Christians. It's like whenever they had the chance, they did so. You know, yep. When they don't have the chance, they don't do it. But whenever they do have the chance, they will do it. Yeah.
Yep. You know what? I heard Rush Limbaugh one time on his radio show. He made some kind of vague statement. If you really want to know something important, read the Book of Acts. So I read the Book of Acts, and I sent him an email while he was on the air. I said, what am I supposed to get out of the Book of Acts, that Jews do a lot of rioting when they don't get what they want? Because that's what happens in the Book of Acts.
Oh.
And I heard Limbaugh make some negative comment on the air, but maybe it was because of that. The article continues to give in detail the persecution to which the Jews subjected their own people who were progressive. It reminds one of the warning given to Rabbi Isaac M. Wise by Rabbi Lilienthal when the former was urging the reform of Judaism. If you want to be a Christ, you must expect to be crucified.
I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah.
Oh, that's their attitude. Yeah, you know, that really sums it up quite well. So that was Rabbi Isaac Meyer Wise.
Yeah. Father of Stephen S. Wise, I believe.
Oh, boy. Figures.
Yeah, the Reform Judaism is a kind of an Americanized Judaism, and they try to emphasize certain similarities between Judaism and Christianity. They like to claim that Jesus was a Jewish prophet, something like that, although they don't accept him as, you know, their Judaism, you know.
Right, anyway. he was a what do you call that? Somebody who went off on the
heretic.
A heretic or something.
Readers of course, Orthodox Jews don't accept that at all. They would not say he was not a Jew at all. Readers of Gibbon's Rise and Fall of the Roman Empire will recall that in Volume 1, Chapter 16, he wrote severe words about the cruelty of the Jews. It will be agreed that only records of the most staggering cruelty could have driven the calm historian to the use of such terms. Readers will also observe in the passage herewith quoted that the desire for the empire of the earth, which actuated the Jews of that period, is the same as that discovered in the protocols. from the reign of Nero to that of Antoninus Pius, the Jew discovered a fierce impatience of the dominion of Rome, which repeatedly broke out in the most furious massacres and insurrections. Humanity is shocked at the recital of the horrid cruelties which they committed in the cities of Egypt, of Cyprus, and of Cyrene, where they dealt in the treacherous friendship with the unsuspecting natives. And we are tempted to applaud the severe retaliation which was exercised by the arm of the legions against a race of fanatics, whose dire and credulous superstitions seemed to render them implacable enemies, not only of the Roman government, but of humankind. The enthusiasm of the Jews was supported by the flattering promise which they derived from their ancient oracles, that a conquering Messiah would soon arise, destined to break their fetters and to invest the favorites of heaven with the empire of the earth.
That's a very good ending there. But they really did believe, and they do believe, those who take it seriously, that this Messiah is going to come, and they're going to be given the rulership of the earth, of the world. That's their whole deal.
Yeah. In footnotes to this passage, Gibbon gives revolting details of the methods used by the Jews of that period. In all this work, the Jewish idea has the assistance of certain Christian sects who gloss over the inhumanity and immorality of certain courses of actions by saying that these are doubtless the means by which God is giving the Jew his promised control of the world. This is one form of the unbiblical conception, the unscriptural teaching, that the Jews are God's chosen people. Of all the sects following this error, none is more active than the so-called Russellites, the followers of Pastor Russell, officially known as the International Bible Students Association. And most of there was a schism in that organization, I think, around 1931, and most of them became what we know today as Jehovah's Witnesses.
Right, and so the Jehovah's Witnesses, I used to know more about them, but I've forgotten. They think that they are the original God's chosen people, and that they follow the Old Testament, and that they're going to be in charge of the world themselves someday. Is that what they think?
Well, I don't know much about the Jehovah's Witnesses, but it seems to be a form of premillennialism. There are several forms of premillennialism in the United States that arose, I believe, in the United States, you know, baptism being one. There are several of them. Yeah, any religious denomination that talks about Bible prophecy is of that ilk. They tend to put more emphasis on the book of Revelations than the Gospels.
Yeah, yeah.
And they ignore things in the Gospels, like the fact that Jesus says that the Jews are no longer the chosen people. It's right there in the Gospels.
And yeah.
The followers of Jesus Christ become the chosen people.
So these Jehovah's Witnesses are people who have respect for the Jews, for today's Jews, or do they think they are those people? I don't know. Anyway.
Well, he's telling us right here that the Jehovah's Witnesses regard the Jews as still the chosen people, which is exactly what the Gospels say they are not.
Yeah. Okay. Well, if we have time at the end, we can talk more about that.
Maybe somebody will call in. It has been reported to the Dearborn Independent by numerous witnesses that Jewish interpreters at points of debarkation in Canada and the United States have circulated Russellite literature. The fact that a Jew would circulate any kind of Christian literature is sufficiently astonishing to cause inquiry. It is explained by the elaborate pro-Jewish propaganda which Russellism is conducting. Not to go into this extensively at this time, suffice it to refer to a handbill advertising in the Russian quarters of American cities. The fact that the literature is circulated among Russians, and that meetings are held in Russian sections of our cities, would seem to indicate a desire to explain the too credulous Russians that Bolshevism too should be received as part of the circumstance by which the Jews are to obtain world rule. The handbills are headed, "The Fifth Universal Kingdom." And in every meeting reported, the speakers have declared that in 1914, the rule of the world was taken away from us, that is, the non-Jews, who are the so-called Gentiles, and was given to God's chosen people, who, according to this sect, are the Jews.
Gosh.
Acquiescence in Bolshevism and every other form of revolutionary overturning is acquiescence in the will of God. The teaching that world rule is already in the hand of the Jew is so novel, so unrelated to biblical sources, as to warrant careful scrutiny for possible pro-Jewish connections. But Palestine is not yet a fact, and other Bible students see in the present political movement a daring and God-defiant scheme destined to failure. Certainly there are great obstacles in the way, moral obstacles, matters of honor and humanity, which do not promise easily to disappear. The Jews of the world are discovering that they read too much into the Balfour Declaration, and that Great Britain is not ready to violate her obligations to the Arabs. Jewish leaders are beginning to feel the weight of realities in the settlement of the land itself. The Jews are not going back. Those who have gone back are, a considerable and influential number of them, tainted with Russian Bolshevism. The English people themselves are becoming dubious about the situation, as is shown by the dispatch of the London correspondent of the Detroit News, printed in the August 14th issue of that paper. "Then there is the scarcity of accurate information from Palestine. The High Commissioner, Sir Herbert Samuel, transmits reports to the British government, but they are not published. Even the report which he made on going to Palestine 2 years ago to inquire into the exact status of affairs never has been made public. Lord Sydenham asked for it in the House of Lords, and though Lord Curzon replied that the report contained nothing unsuitable for publication, it has never been given out. It is also charged that the Zionist Commission maintains a strict censorship, that even a petition to the king disappeared in transit, that letters have to be written guardedly. A series of articles by the special correspondent of the Times suddenly ceased, though the last, May 17th, bore the line, "To be continued." News from Palestine is exceedingly scanty, and no one knows whether what does come through is trustworthy. It has been printed that Sir Herbert Samuel does not dare ride through the streets of Jerusalem without an armored car in attendance. For these reasons, there is a great deal of suspicion in England that all is not well in Palestine. The most outspoken word that has yet been uttered on the political dilemma in which Zionism places the Jew appeared in an editorial entitled Political Judaism in the Christian Century of Chicago, a publication of Weight and Character, which also published a lot of heterodox information about what was going on in Germany after the Second World War. Political loyalty is one. Under the present world order, it does not admit of division. The citizens of any nation may maintain a platonic admiration for the political systems of neighboring nations, but their ultimate loyalty cannot be platonized. Spiritual Judaism is one thing. A Palestinian state or a Jewish political organization anywhere else is a very different thing, at least in Gentile estimation. Once a Jewish state is set up in Palestine, insofar as it is accepted as the proper expression of Judaism, the Jew of the diaspora must surrender his religion. Is there any escape from this issue? The Jew can be a Jew anywhere, so long as his religious adherence carries with it no political implications. At least he can be an acknowledged Jew in every land where religious freedom is guaranteed or practiced. And even in states where an established religion other than Jewish debars him from the fullest and highest participation in the affairs of state, he can still hold to his religion without too serious embarrassment. But what would be the status of the Jew in any land of the present world when the profession of his religion would inevitably identify him with the fortunes and aspirations and diplomacy, even with the military policies, of a political state alien to the society of his residence and citizenship? The status seems, at least to the Gentile mind, altogether impossible. A revival of anti-Semitism and its spread to lands where heretofore it has not prevailed is not the least embarrassing of the inevitable results of such a move. How can the Jewish outlander maintain his own spiritual and mental integrity? It is not even necessary to imagine a possible precipitation of war between the new Jewish state and the land of his citizenship. War is not, let us hope, the necessary condition or even potentiality among separate political states. But it remains true, by the very nature of the present system of political organization, that political loyalty is one and cannot be divided. Hyphenation, discriminating Americans are by this time well aware, must remain spiritual, or racial, or sentimental. It dare not become political under any circumstances. If the proposed new Jewish state in Palestine is to be and remain a province or dominion of the British Empire, the way is smoothed for any Jew residing and claiming citizenship in any portion of the British Empire. But the way is decidedly roughened for the Jew elsewhere. The Briton is honored, especially in times of peace, in most regions of the world, for his connection with so magnificent a political structure. But for that very reason, his political loyalty is the more emphasized in his own mind and scrutinized by citizens of other political units. A Jew identified with so insignificant a power as an independent Palestinian state must forever be, and would, in many lands and on many occasions be, in a far more advantageous position when a resident of an outlying nation than if he were recognized as a Briton. The anticipated dependence of a new Palestine upon British sovereignty thus fails to relieve the embarrassment of Zionism. it would seem rather to compound it. There you go.
Okay, we completed that. Issue 27, August 1921. Well, you know, this is very interesting what he's talking about here. It's very pertinent to today with this idea of the dual citizenship and so on, which is what he's getting at here, and saying that it would just never work out. But it has, hasn't it? I mean, but they are getting in trouble. I think today, Jews and Zion, Jews who are for Israel and so on, and because of there's such a is in an increase in the anti-Israel feeling because of Israel's terrible behavior.
Well, you see, the great irony there, as it turns out, is that he thinks that an independent Jewish state would be less of a problem, you know, and have less conflict with other nations than a colony of the British Empire. And that's hardly the case. The Jews have found plenty of conflicts on their own and dragged the rest of us into them.
Well, that's right. Yeah, I guess. All these things, it's interesting to see how people were thinking then. And, you know, naturally with all the hindsight, we can see exactly what happened. But you didn't know what was going to happen then. But it's the idea, it seems like, is that it's a problem. You know, this damn Jewish state is a problem. And Jews all over the world, you've got the Jewish diaspora, and then you've got the Jews in the state of in the Jewish state. I don't see, do you think, how is that ever going to be acceptable or work out except if the Jews are actually in control of the world as the chosen people? And the center of the chosen people is Jerusalem, which is where they want to put that high world Supreme Court, you know, that they've had plans for that for so long. Nobody gets excited about that. How horrible that that's going to be in Jerusalem. And they have to have Jerusalem for their own. They don't want to share it with the Muslims and the Arabs. And so the only way any of this stuff works out is that their whole goal is to rule the world.
Well, I mean, the logical thing to do, if all, assuming that all Jews are, affiliated with this Jewish state, the logical thing to do is to not let them have dual citizenship. It's like, okay, you're Israelis. If you're here, you're a resident alien, but you're not going to vote. You're not going to hold office. You're not going to own media here.
That's right. Well, I agree, but nobody has the will to do that. And Jews are in control of our political system, American Jew. So, but that's the answer. Well, this was an interesting chapter. I like running into that 6,000 number and a few other things that I thought were pretty interesting. But wherever they end that, the way and how they want to attack other people, and particularly Christians, and how violent they've been all through their history, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, especially in ancient times.
Yeah, really. But we sort of excuse that. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we'll be back next week with the next chapter. Good night.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.